Hey everyone, welcome in to a daily editorial here on the KE Report. We're kicking off this week's daily editorials with a conversation with Dr. Jim Jones, private investor and one who is well known to everybody who visits CEO.ca, as well as on our site, as we have been bringing Doc Jones back on a bit of a more regular basis to get his thoughts, usually on the metals complex, but always touching on some of the stocks that he is doing his due diligence on. Doc Jones, we're going to talk a little bit more about the energy sector, at least first and foremost here, because oil, even though it went through a bit of a correction in July and August, put in another pretty solid looking bottom, it looks like, right around that $61 a level, and now it's right back up in the mid-70s as we're recording this, right around $74 a barrel. Look, the fact of the matter is there seems to be a bit of a supply crunch for the oil sector, and overall, as many bears as there could be in the oil sector, price is telling us that it really looks like oil could have another leg higher here. What are your first and foremost big picture thoughts here, Doc Jones, on the oil sector?
Hi, Corey. Hey, Chad. Nice to talk with you both. My general thoughts are, I think oil and gas, the sector itself, is probably going to be one of the more outperforming sectors in the next few years. Globally, we're heading towards an energy crisis, it looks like. For the last two decades, there's been underdevelopment. Capital spending had been cut, projects had been shelved that would have provided future supply to deal with natural depletion globally. The global depletion rate is about 6-7% a year. So currently, we produce about 100 million barrels a day. So every year, we have to bring online 7 million barrels a day just to stay flat while demand is still growing and is going to continue to grow for the next decade or two, even though that we're shifting to green energy and electric cars and things like that. It really doesn't make a dent. And I think there's a misconception out there that people think that oil is primarily used for transportation. Only 30% of oil demand is for transportation. So that leaves the other 70% or 70 million barrels a day that goes into non-transportation, which is fairly inelastic as far as replacing them with something else. And, you know, chemicals and fertilizers, all those things that use petroleum-based products, including natural gas, the demand growth there will continue for as long as we have human beings, right? There's nothing to replace that. I think what we're seeing is that the converging of many tailwinds for oil and gas. For one, you had OPEC that is conforming to its production cuts. You have the United States, which has made it very clear that they do not want to support the oil and gas industry or make expand production. Banks now can deny loans to the oil and gas sector based on them being in that sector, where before they couldn't. That was something that was passed in the U.S. recently. So capital, it's a capital-starved sector that is capital-intensive, so you do not get the production gains. And the United States, the shale oil is what basically kept us from the last energy crisis, and that's pretty much flattening off and going into terminal decline. The decline rates of those wells are incredibly high. They decline 60, 70, 80% in the first year. You get all your production shot up front, so your paybacks are quick. But then a well that produced 1,000 barrels a day 2 years later is producing, 100, 150 barrels. So you have to constantly be drilling and putting capital into that, into the ground, to keep production flat or grow it from at a company level. So that's kind of the story, I guess, of oil and gas. And if you believe in the green movement, that everything's going electrified, that means natural gas, right? Natural gas generation. I haven't seen any decommissioning of natural gas plants, whereas they're adding them. Like in the state of California, they've permitted to build 3 more natural gas fire electric generation plants there, as well as in other countries. They're all natural gas as well for electric generation. So I think there's a really good opportunity in the Canadian producers as well as in South America. because in the Caribbean, Mexico, Trinidad and Tobago, Colombia, they're all net short gas. And their prices there, like, for example, in Colombia, the NYMEX is about $5. In Colombia, the gas is $7. And if you construct an LNG export terminal, you can take your gas to as far as Japan, where you get $22 an MCF. That's on a BOE conversion. That's over it's like almost $130 a barrel. And with the United States making it incredibly hard for production to be increased because of limiting the amount of capital that can go into the Permian Basin, which the primary byproduct of drilling those shale oil wells was natural gas, which kept prices very low for natural gas for the last decade. People forget that prior to the discovery of the Permian Basin and the shale plays there, as well as the Bakken, that natural gas prices were around $8 to $12 an MCFE. Natural gas used to trade pretty closely of 6 to 1 for oil. And we're seeing that now. It used to be a few years ago, you were getting 30 to 1, 40 to 1 pricing. And now we're at 12 to 1. So we're getting a compression there of that ratio, and it will continue to do so. So I think the Canadian oil and gas producers have a real advantage because they price they get US dollars, you know, for their product. The ones that have capacity to put their gas on a pipeline and send it south, as well as, you know, they're dealing in their local currency, which is very cheap. So you're paying your fixed costs in Canadian dollars, selling oil and gas in U.S. dollars. And there's a great arbitrage there that exists for some of those companies up there.
Well, Doc, let me jump in here and just mention that I was reading over the last couple of days an article, and it was discussing some of the commercial hedgers that were short oil futures have actually started covering, and this has helped the oil prices rise. And we were talking off mic about some of the companies themselves that were hedged on their production have a lot of those hedges coming off. So let's shift the focus over to some of the companies that people can invest in and what you're seeing in the marketplace there, because that seems like a positive sign for revenues for some of these companies moving forward. What's your outlook on some of the companies and some of these hedges coming off and some of the hedgers covering their shorts?
From an investment standpoint, if you're looking at an investment in oil and gas, you want to look at their hedge book and see what product they have hedged. Like, there are some companies up in Canada that have very little hedging, maybe 10-20%. Like, there's a company that's in my portfolio that I've talked about, i3 Energy, which I introduced you guys to about 8 months ago when it was at around 12 cents. Today it's about 26, I think. Because they acquired all these assets during the bottom of the COVID crash, they came to Canada from the UK and acquired a bunch of different companies in Canada for basically 10 cents on the dollar. And so they had no hedging. You know, they have about 10 or 15% hedged right now as far as just to cover cash flow in the event of some kind of crash or whatnot. But they're getting spot pricing. And so you can find companies that their earnings are, say, I don't know, a dollar a share currently now. And you're going, wow, they're an oil and gas company. They should be making more. Something must be wrong. Go and look at their hedge book. Chances are their hedges are going to roll off in the next quarter or two. And then they have their gas or oil hedged at $40, gas at $2. They're immediately going to get a huge bump in earnings and cash flow because that flows right to the bottom line. So that's something very important to look at. Conversely, you know, there are companies that have done aggressive hedging. Generally, companies don't hedge more than 2 years in advance, 18 months. So you want to see that some companies are required to hedge at least 50% of their production because of their debt covenants. So you want to find a company. Like, there's a company, I'm not invested in this one, I was, but not anymore, Kelt Exploration in Canada. They have zero debt. And the same thing with i3 Energy. They have, I think, $30 million in debt that's not due for 2 years, and their operating income so far that they've slated would be at around, from about $65 oil, is about $90 million US. against a market cap of $200 million. So, you know, there's a lot of nitty-gritty stuff when investing in oil and gas. Like, you want to take a look at the production. What type of oil are they producing? What type of gas? You know, because there's natural gas, there's natural gas liquids, there's propane. You know, all those things get different pricing. But in general, a lot of these companies did hedge during the COVID crisis because, if you remember, oil prices went negative, everything collapsed, so people were forced to hedge out of fear that this would be a protracted lockdown, right? And those are all rolling off. And you're seeing, like, the average gain in the companies that I follow, that I have 10 companies in Canada that I follow, I think the average is about 300% for this year as far as appreciation. And all these companies are paying down debt tremendously. They're becoming leaner and meaner because also the capital isn't available to them like it used to be. So they are being very disciplined with the way that they grow production. They're paying down debt, paying it off, paying dividends, doing buybacks, and ensuring that they will have a stable, flexible business for the next few decades. And I think you're going to see a lot of consolidation as well, because people are leaving the industry. You've got the majors selling off all their assets that are domiciled in the United States because they want to get, because of ESG reasons, right? But what you're going to see is capital is going to go to Canada and South America, offshore Africa, North Sea, not so much. They're having some of their own political issues there as far as allowing oil and gas development. But and you're going to see consolidation there. And with consolidation, you get you're able to become a price maker versus a price taker, right? Because there's less people offering the product. You know, it goes back to economics 101. I think it's a very, very exciting time to be in oil and gas for that reason, because you're getting dividends, capital return, capital discipline, plus a backdrop of a lack of long-term supply, stable demand going forward for the next two decades at least, and incremental demand being added from the transition towards a greener economy through electric generation, specifically through natural gas. Yeah, so that's where I sit with that.
So, Doc Jones, what about looking at the energy sector from an income perspective, too? Some companies, a lot of companies, still pay dividends, and some of these stocks, you can make the argument that still have some capital gains to take in, even as you're getting those dividends. Are you looking at any of these dividend-paying stocks and their potential role in your portfolio?
Yeah, well, I do have a separate portfolio outside of my junior mining or junior oil and gas, let's say. I do have a specific income portfolio, and part of that portfolio is comprised of MLPs, which are master limited partnerships in the United States, mainly pipeline companies, midstream companies, because regardless, you know, there's gas and oil is going to flow back and forth across the country, whether it's produced at the wellhead or imported through the Gulf of Mexico or off the coast. It has to be moved around, and pipelines they're fantastic because it's a huge economic moat around there. Once someone sinks the capital in to put in a pipeline, no one's going to build one right next to you, you know. So those are really, really great operations, and for income, yeah, definitely, and some of the upstream companies too, depending on the type of production they have. If they're more conventional production, where they have the decline rates are fairly shallow as far as in the total portfolio, which means they don't have to invest a lot of capital to keep production flat, and therefore throw off a lot of cash flow that can be paid to investors. That's good. Also, in this time, because if you're in Canada, if you do the currency exchange, they're getting almost $100 a barrel, right, for oil for Edmonton Sweet, which generally gets WTI minus $2 or $3 right now, right? So also there's another thing to look at when you're doing your economic models on an investment. Let's say a company had $100 million in debt that they were paying 6% on, right? So that's, you know, $6 million a year that they're paying for debt, plus also the payments that they have to make on it. They're doing well enough where they're going to extinguish that debt in the next year. You know, the interest servicing cost and the capital that's tied up in servicing that debt, making those incremental payments to pay down the debt, suddenly is freed up, right? You get the immediate cash flow bump to the bottom line from what you were paying in interest servicing, and you free up the capital for growing production or doing share buybacks from what would have been your amortization schedule on the debt. So, there's many ways to look at the investment and find the things that most retail and, frankly, institutional investors will miss. That's another thing. It's kind of off topic, but I think retail investors think that institutional investors are so much smarter. They're really not. And I know because I talk to a lot of them. It's not uncommon that I'll talk to an institutional investor about a certain investment, and he knows less than the retail investors that I talk to about, you know. So you do have that advantage if you're willing to do the homework and look at all the different steps of how the business will be affected by the increased pricing. And you can model out a year, 18 months from now, using a flat pricing, and say the incremental increase in cash flow it's going to increase 3 or 4x, meaning that the share price should at least double or triple in that time. And the main key ingredient, which I find that is lacking and a lot of retail investors, is patience. You know, you have to have a reasonable time frame for these investments. You know, the i3 Energy is a great example. It basically was around 12 cents, spiked up to around 30 cents, came back down, stayed around 18, 19 cents for months and months and months. It was boring, and investing should be boring with little respites of excitement. And then suddenly, I don't know why the price started going up. Commodity prices went up, but in the last couple of weeks, it's gone up, 30%. So, you have to have a thesis and know what questions you're looking to be answered within that thesis. And when you get those answers, then you have to decide, is it good? Is it bad? Do I add? Do I hold? Do I sell? You know, but the reasonable time frame is the most important aspect of it, right? So that's my speech, Corey.
Well, Doc, I just have one more quick question for you as we wrap up here, and it could just be a short answer. There's a lot of investors that may not want to take individual company risk, but they want to maybe use an ETF. And there's three big ones. You know, there's the XLE for the larger producers. There's the XOP for the explorers and developers. And there's the OIH for the oil services. Of the three areas, the big producers, the developers, explorers, or the oil services, which one are you most bullish on moving towards the end of the year and moving into next year?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I think services is the place you should stay away from for the reasons I outlined earlier. If you think about it, if the United States is making it harder for people to drill and whatnot, these service companies are going to have rigs and compression units and all that laying around that aren't being utilized, so rates are going to go low. It'll be low for them, regardless of how high the prices of oil and gas go. As far as if you want to do like an ETF, I would personally tell people to take a look at Nine Points Partners. That's a Canadian company. Eric Nuttall runs it. He's the top performing oil and gas investor in Canada. And they have a fund there. It trades on, the TSX big board, and it might be on the New York as well or the NASDAQ. But it's only in Canadian companies. Because the problem with the other ETFs, they are loaded with a lot of multinational as well as U.S. companies, and I think they're going to be very challenged to grow. Because that's the thing, you need to be able. You want a company that can actually grow, right? I don't see in the old days, like 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when I was investing in the Eagle Ford and in the Bakken Shale and those areas, you would invest in a company because you knew if it got enough scale that the majors would buy you out. That's not going to happen in the United States anymore. The majors are leaving, right? So who's the buyer of those assets? There isn't one, right? Whereas in Canada, there's a lot of consolidation, and I can see that and the Canadian companies have always had better balance sheet discipline than the U.S. ones. So that's why I'd say, I don't own, and I'm not affiliated at all with Nine Point Partners. I just follow Eric Nuttall. He's one of the best oil analysts, in my opinion, in the world as far as covering Canadian companies. So I would direct people towards, they have a managed ETF, I think, and then our managed fund, and then they have an ETF. Aside from that, that's as far as an ETF or a mutual fund per se, that's where I would go. That's how I would look at that.
All right, Doc Jones, interesting comments, man. Lots to cover within this oil sector, but look, oil has been doing well in the stocks. The argument being that some have lagged, but you know what, in this environment where undoubtedly you got to think some investors are finally starting to wake up and say, hey, maybe oil is going to stay in the 70s. Maybe it's even going to go higher. Money, hopefully, should flow back into a few more of these oil companies. But again, at least with the oil companies, it is all about profitability. Doc Jones, we got to wrap it up here. It's great chatting with you. Great having you back on the show. We'll definitely be chatting with you again soon. Hope you have a great rest of your week.
No, thanks, Corey. Thanks, Shad. And you have a great weekend as well.